Hello, and thank you for listening to Raleigh Little Theater's podcast in support of our production of What We're Up Against by Teresa Rabeck. My name is Patrick Torres, and I'm the artistic director here at Raleigh Little Theater, and I'm also your host for this podcast. Thank you so much for clicking play, because this next production is one that is absolutely worthy of some discussion. You know, we've been producing these podcasts in order to give you all, our listeners, a chance to really add some context to the play that you're about to see. So we're really thankful that you're taking the time to listen and that you're curious about the work that we're doing. So What We're Up Against is a play that I saw several years back in Houston, Texas at the Alley Theater. And it's really stuck with me, and I've been really excited to get it produced here at Raleigh Little Theater. It takes place in a highly competitive architecture firm and really centers around five characters, three men and two women. And the play demonstrates the effects of sexism and gender politics and the different ways that men and women communicate and also fight for work inside of an office situation. So we really feel like the play is relevant. We really feel like it has a lot to say. And we are really excited about the team of people who will be bringing it to you, particularly our director, Heather Strickland. Heather has worked at Raleigh Little Theater quite often, and she's our volunteer board representative at the moment. And she's just been fantastic. And I really knew this was a play for her. One of the things that's always intrigued me about Heather's process as a director is she really enjoys bringing experts on the thematic nature of the material into the rehearsal room to work with her actors and their whole creative team. And now that we have this venue of podcast, we thought it'd be really interesting for you all to get a chance to kind of experience a little bit of Heather's process. So she has assembled three experts on the topics represented in the play, and that's how we're going to produce these podcasts. So we're going to release a series of three podcasts, and each one gives us different insight into the text. So this first one that you're listening to today, we'll just start with an interview with Heather. I sat down with her to talk about her feelings about the play and just what she's excited about as it gets ready to open. And you'll also hear from Dr. Sharon Cannon, who is definitely an expert on communication between men and women in the workplace. And I'm really excited for you to hear what she has to say. So I hope that you will listen to all of these podcasts, all three of them, and I definitely hope that you'll join us for the show. But here is my interview with the director, Heather Strickland. All right, listeners, I'm here today with Heather Strickland, who is our director for What We're Up Against. She's also our volunteer board representative. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm so super glad that you're going to direct this show. I guess I approached you about a year ago with this script and said, I really want you to do the show. And so let's talk about our first meeting after you read the show. tell everybody a little bit about what you said to me, what happened.
Yeah, so I think one of the first things that I said to you, I was certainly feeling a little uncertain. You know, I was incredibly honored that you had come to me and said you really wanted me to direct this show. But after reading the script the first time, I think the first thing I said to you was, you handed me a script about sexism that almost doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
Yeah, tell everybody what the Bechdel test is.
So the Bechdel test is kind of just this litmus test of the stories that we're telling. And it has to have two named female characters that have an interaction or conversation that is about something other than a man. Mm-hmm. So, right, two named female characters that have to have a conversation that is not about a man. And this script has a fleeting moment that could be considered passing the Bechdel test, but it's not prevalent in the script.
Yeah, so I handed you this crazy script that I sold to you as like a feminist piece.
Yeah.
And it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Okay, good. So then at that lunch you kept saying...
I don't remember what I kept saying, but I kept thinking like, all right, I'm going to direct this show. How do I get over this? Because I think, you know, my immediate reaction to this script was I was pissed. It was a very emotional reaction. And of course, now I've had many months to reflect on that reaction and kind of realize that my reaction was to the story and not necessarily the script. So it took me some time before I understood that, you know, the beauty and the challenge of this script is that we have to tell the story of sexism within the current reality of the sexist environment that we are all operating in right now.
So tell us a little bit about that journey from that kind of fear or that anger of being pissed to now being excited about the process.
Well, you know, certainly talking to a lot of really intelligent people about the script and them sort of breaking down, you know, this is indicative of what we truly are up against, and not just what women are up against, it's what we're all up against. And I think that that's a really important point that the script does help to identify, because you know, yes, it clearly tells the story of Eliza, who's having trouble in her current work environment, but it tells it in a way that it's showing the male perspective on that, which is an important part to understanding what we truly are all up against. Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit about, I know that one of the reasons I wanted you to direct this play and asked you to do it is I know that as a director, you really want community experts, mm-hmm. People to surround your rehearsal process with that just have lived experience and also information to share with you and your actors. So can you talk a little bit about how you'll bring people in to work with your actors? And also, as we prepare to, or you know, people are listening right now to this podcast, we're going to release three of them with three folks you've invited to have conversations with us. Can you tell us a little bit about them as well?
Absolutely. I love the rehearsal process. And I love creating great theater with incredibly talented people. But it's not, for me, it's never about just getting to that end point of putting up that really great production. It is about all the discovery and the adventure and the journey that is a part of the process. It's always a tremendous learning environment and a growing environment. And the artist of me loves that just as much as watching that final product. And, you know, something that I discovered a couple years ago, I directed an all-female cast and crew production of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. And, you know, part of why I wanted to do that was to really better understand female relationships, you know, with the understanding that so often females hold each other down more than maybe male populations may do to us. And so, you know, how the question was, you know, how for one moment in time, which was that rehearsal process, do we bring a group of women together that are focused on taking care of each other, supporting each other, and working together to create this great piece of theater? And so not only did we focus on telling the story that we needed to tell, which was a very tough story to tell just because of the nature of Titus Andronicus, but also let's build that community. Let's build that community of female artists that are going to support each other. And so we brought in one of the experts that we're bringing in to help work on this show is Clara Cunahan from the UNC Women's Center. And she led some discussions with the group of women that worked on that show about, you know, let's think about your personal life and think about the interactions that you have had with women and where could you have supported when you tore down, or when were you torn down when you should have been supported? And then let's examine that and let's understand why, and let's understand kind of the systematic reasons for why those things happen. And mm-hmm. So this group of women engaged in that learning process together and overcame some of those things because they were made aware of these things that just kind of systematically happen that destroys their relationships with other women. They could see them and then not allow them to be a part of this process. Mm-hmm. And so that group of women, they still to this day, they started calling each other monsters. And so they're the monsters of Titus. And they still communicate with each other, lean on each other, and still feel a very strong connection to that group of monsters, mm-hmm. Which is a really wonderful thing. So as part of this, we're going to be doing that sort of thing again. And we have already scheduled as part of our rehearsal process to bring in Claire, as well as Dr. Sharon Cannon, who specializes in gender communications in the workplace. And they're going to come in, and one whole rehearsal process is going to be dedicated to them leading a discussion so that we can better understand socialized sexism and what happens in the workplace. And then we're actually going to do some work with the script and figure out what are some of the different communication styles that happen specifically in the workplace between men and women, and what does that cause? Like, what does that lead to, and why is it so much harder for women to get work done because of just those differences in communication styles?
Excellent. And then our last guest that you got on board,
yes,
is from the world of politics.
Yes.
So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So Senator Jay Chaudhary is a long friend of mine. We actually worked together several years ago at the Department of State Treasurer. And, you know, certainly in that environment, he supported the first elected female state treasurer and kind of got to experience what that was like, certainly a strong woman in finance. And then also what it was like for a woman to be in an elected position. And certainly had a very real-world experience of what she was up against in that position. And plus, you know, works so hard as one of our senators now to really think about public policy in a way that serves all, you know, and make sure that it's equitable, and what are the policy supports that need to be in place for these kind of social changes.
Okay, so listeners, now we're here with Dr. Sharon Cannon. Hi, Dr. Cannon.
Hi, call me Sharon.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit first about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I'm a clinical associate professor of management corporate communication here at the Keenan Flagler Business School at UNC Chapel Hill. And mostly what I do is I teach people how to deliver effective presentations, how to write really well for the workplace, but I also have a real interest in intercultural communication and also in gender communication, because a lot of misunderstandings come about because of those things, and I've been interested in how gender comes into play at work since I was an undergraduate. And what we know is that women and men are socialized differently in terms of communication skills, and so it comes into play in so many settings. I notice it a lot when I'm coaching people with presentations.
Yeah, that's so exciting. That's exciting work, and we're just thrilled to have your perspective on this play as we help our audiences get prepared to wrestle with what they're going to see. And even after they see it, maybe come back to this to just continue to build their perception of how the play even works with these characters. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Yes.
Absolutely. Delighted to do so. Enjoyed reading the play. Thanks for sharing it with me.
Well, and I think that's a great segue, Sharon. You know, I had the opportunity to talk to you shortly after you had finished reading the script, but I'd love for everyone to just kind of hear what your initial thoughts were after reading this story.
Well, one of the things I think that people who go to the play are going to realize is that all the characters are flawed. And that was something I know you and I had talked about on the phone. But what was interesting to me was really how some of the things I think about gender communication came out in the situation. We have this stereotype sometimes, for example, that men won't stop and ask for directions. It's something women laugh about a lot. But the reality is that happens a lot because of how we're socialized differently. And women are socialized, it's actually okay to ask questions to get clarification. And men, I think, in terms of the way they grow up with each other as boys, tend to be a little bit more worried about the impression they're going to make, if they look confident, you know, what are people going to think if they don't know the answer. So it's an age-old stereotype, but I felt like it came into play in the play. Mm-hmm. So what we saw was really these men being very caught up and needing to be the powerful ones in the situation, not really receptive to women. And the thing was is that the person who had the best idea about solving a mechanical problem in an architectural situation they were dealing with was a woman. It was Eliza. And they didn't really want to have to go to her, to have to get the answer from her. They somehow wanted to believe that somehow they could figure it out without her. And it was like they were being threatened in a way in terms of their own ability to do what they felt like men could do better, which was architecture, by this woman who might actually be able to solve a mechanical problem better than they could.
Hmm. Yeah, that's certainly true. So, you know, I love kind of your perspective and how you related that to that asking for directions metaphor that I think we're all certainly familiar with. What advice would you have given to Eliza if, you know, you were one of her friends and she came to you with this situation?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because isn't that what the other female character did, was give her a lot of advice, but a lot of it wasn't particularly helpful, I thought. But the thing that we laugh about a lot of times is that we get in this dilemma when we're working with women about how sometimes when these issues come up for women in work environments, we always seem to be coaching the women about how to handle them, and we don't tend to actually think very much about, well, what should we be saying to, say, the guys in the play? What should we be saying to Ben? What should we be saying to Stu, right? So we think about actually trying to help Eliza deal with her scenario. But if I were giving her advice, I think that it would really be along the lines of helping her know how to deal with men like that. Not so much that she has to change so much or there's something wrong with her, but to help her understand the dynamics of the situation that were going on. And really, since she didn't feel like the other women at work with her, really Janice, was terribly supportive, to actually look outside of that dysfunctional environment and find someone who could be supportive of her, who could really be a true sounding board for her. And also to think about how she might talk to these men about what's going on. It's interesting because it made me think of a situation or a story at another university where I once taught, where I had a woman who was on a team, everybody else on the team was guys, and she was an undergraduate. And she was probably one of the sharpest students I had ever taught, and she's already in her 20s, already the CEO of an organization. But back then when she was an undergraduate on this team, she really wanted to make a good grade. It wasn't just the grade, she wanted to really do well on the project in the class. And the other guys were more thinking about what's the least we could do, you know, to get by and get the grade we want, not how can we really do well on this. And it was not her ethic at all. And so when she was speaking up in the group, they literally told her to shut up. And so she came to talk to me about it, not as the professor, as in intervene, these guys told me to shut up, do something about it, but more from the advice perspective of, I know I'm going to have to deal with some guys like this out here someday. Can you give me some advice for how to handle them? And so what we talked about was her speaking to them about the behaviors, what they were saying, how it was affecting her, and trying to figure out if they could come to some kind of a compromise on how they would approach the situation so that she felt like they would have a better outcome.
I would like to kind of dig into some of the other pieces that you and I had discussed earlier about the difference in communication styles and how that sort of perpetuates this sexism in the workplace and what happens in those different communication styles that kind of drives these differences and socialized sexism.
Well, someone that I really love is a person named Deborah Tannen, and she's a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. So what she's done in her career is research how socialization plays out at work. And she distilled her knowledge into a really popular book in 1994, which was called Talking from 9 to 5, Women at Men at Work. And then later on, she put out a Harvard Business Review article, The Power of Talk, Who Gets Heard and Why. And even 20 years later, from this initial writing she did, I see some of the same things she pointed out. So, for example, how direct or indirect do you speak to others? And men are really socialized to be a little more direct in their style, because women are probably socialized more to care about other people's feelings in a situation. And so sometimes the feedback or the response to a situation will be more indirect. Or do you pause? So listeners are people who allow more pauses when they speak. And the thing that's interesting is men are taught more to fill in those spaces. So, and sometimes men will interpret in the conversation, if a woman is quieter or listening, that maybe she doesn't have anything to say. Whereas what she might really be doing is being a really good listener. Or jokes. So I have a brother who was a class clown, still is as an adult, and you know, I noticed him that he told jokes to get attention, and it was almost kind of jockey for status with the other guys or to get along with people. And I don't think women do that so much with each other. Women seem to, in Deborah Tan's research, show the same thing. Women tend to communicate a little bit more to build the relationship. And men, boys, they tend to have conversations that are more to show their status in the group. They give orders more to each other. And you see that sort of thing continuing in the workplace. Men joking more, giving more orders, women pausing more, perhaps listening. And then one thing that women get socialized to do that they know they need to do less is apologizing more often. You know, saying sorry for something they really don't need to say sorry for. Women get taught to speak more with we language, collaborative language. And so sometimes when people hear we, they don't think that she did anything. You know, or a guy will say, I did this, I did that. She'll say we. She'll speak from a team perspective, but that doesn't mean that she didn't do as much. So another thing is the whole idea of blowing your own horn. And I think men get taught to boast a little more. And women think, wow, that's not how much humility in that, right? And so today we still do that because we're teaching everybody about personal branding, you know, how to go out and tell everybody how great you are. So those are some things that Deborah noticed, and I do see those things. But there's also things that happen that are interesting, like women, sometimes some young women speak with something we call upspeak, which is they ask a question or they make a statement and it sounds like a question. And it happens a lot of times culturally in some female groups, and it has to do with getting along with each other. But if a woman were to do that in a workplace setting, people might think that making a statement that sounds like a question means that she's actually not confident about what she's saying. So we are always in this dilemma, is the woman the problem or is the listener the problem? But I'll usually point out to a woman, do you realize you're speaking with some upspeak and that some men might be listening to you and think you actually aren't very confident about what you just said? So these are some of the things that I notice in terms of how we're socialized differently.
Sure. So what are some of the implications in the workplace for that? So, you know, how does that result in fewer women in executive roles or less women in STEM-related fields?
Right. So I think that it's just that we have a socialized norm about what looks confident. And sometimes that norm, people misunderstand the collaborative approach, the we language, as being a woman who isn't as confident or the pauses. And so, again, a lot of times I will just point the issue out to women, not from a perspective of they have to change, but be aware of what could be happening and try to do some things verbally and nonverbally that can show someone that you do have the ability to be a leader. And I don't just think that this happens with only women. I think some quieter men, we see this in some intercultural situations where the norm is not to be quite as strong, come on, quite as strong as we often teach boys to do. And so I think there's other people other than women who sometimes don't get perceived as leaders who really do have leadership ability.
So I realize that this is a very large question, but in an ideal world, you know, what would gender equity specific to communication styles possibly look like? Is it a broader understanding of different styles or acceptance of what somebody could mean? Or is it taking the time to really dig into and asking questions when there are those interactions in the workplace?
Well, it's interesting because I teach an undergraduate course in intercultural communication. And one of the things I do in that class is I have them read something that I had just referred to earlier, and it's Deborah Tannen's The Power of Talk, Who Gets Heard and Why. That ends up having a wonderful conversation with the men and the women in the class. The women acknowledging, you know, I realize I do that. I realize I do speak with we, or I realize that I do probably apologize too often. And the men saying, I had never thought about these things. No one had ever mentioned this or told me that we're socialized different. And now I can see how I might have been perceiving women to be less confident when actually what they were trying to do was be more collaborative. So sometimes I have just found that even with undergraduates, just reading that article, people get a lot of aha moments. And I think they probably leave the class with a more open attitude. So if we could get that going in the world, that would be terrific. And I think that it helps to have it in a non-threatening situation, which is what I try to do in my classrooms. Mm. Let the students discuss and have some aha moments. And if we could do that in work, then I don't feel like people would feel like, oh, you're just talking about the, you know, how the guys need to change or the women need to change. But reading an article and then being able to discuss it can be a really great opportunity for people to better understand each other.
Thank you for that, Sharon. And I really, like, I feel so inspired by the answers that you're giving and what you're talking about. And but it's making me ask this other question, even thinking about the play. You know, inside of a company or a culture in a company where there's this embedded power differential, like in the play, of course, at this architecture firm, how does someone go about who doesn't have the kind of traditional or stereotypical expressions of confidence? How does someone go about asserting themselves inside of a culture that maybe isn't attuned with or on board with changing? You know, I mean, I think Eliza in the play takes some pretty bold action that we don't, of course, want to spoil for the people who haven't seen the play. She takes some pretty bold action at the end that may or may not work out for her. But is that appropriate? Like, how do you chip away at the embedded culture, especially in these male-dominated fields? What would one do?
Well, it's interesting because one of the females in the play, without totally destroying what happens in the play, gets frustrated. And I think that some of the things that she does, this is why I think everybody is flawed in the play, aren't necessarily going to make things better. But if you watch the play or you read the play like I did, you understand the frustration that she's coming from in terms of where she's being, how she's being treated, and you can kind of understand why she developed some flawed responses. I think it's really hard, and it was hard in her situation, to be within that dysfunctional environment and to actually have the only other female colleague also responding in a dysfunctional way to make some sense of it. So that's why I say sometimes it's nice for people to have mentors or sponsors or people who understand you outside of the organization who can help you sometimes see the insanity of what's going on. And I think there was some insanity going on in this play. But it's helpful to sort of get a reality check. You know, am I crazy? did X just happen to me? What do I do? So that's one thing that I think is helpful. Another thing is that I've been in a situation, not at all to this extent, where I was starting to feel a little of that craziness in terms of it seemed like no matter how I behaved, it didn't get me the results. And I thought, gosh, I'm a good communicator. But I realized that sometimes if you're in a situation that seems a little dysfunctional, sometimes it's just better to go someplace healthy, which is what I did. And wow, that was a great choice that I made. But the thing that I guess bothers me about the scenario in the play, and we know this happens for some women in different fields, is that we hate to see women, for example, leaving STEM fields because they feel like people don't believe in them as women scientists, or you know, in this architecture firm, you know, thinking that women are invading them and they have nothing to offer. You hate to see women driven out of work environments by people who don't think they belong. So, again, I think we can say what should the woman do, but also what should we be doing in our work environments. And what we know is that research is saying that we don't all need to be cookie cutter, that women bring an incredible amount of value to organizations, to boards, and it's not just about, I don't know, it's not a matter of you're letting women do things that they haven't earned. It's a matter of realizing that just because women do it differently doesn't mean they shouldn't be there. And so I think that I hate to see the idea of women leaving fields that are dysfunctional or situations that are dysfunctional. On the other hand, there is a point, I think, that a woman has to take care of herself and find the place where she can be functional, not necessarily leave her field, but in this case, maybe the woman goes to another architecture firm. Hmm. People are a little more enlightened. some things to think about. It's not an easy answer.
It's not an easy answer, but I really appreciate how you kind of brought up both sides of that. I hadn't really considered the thought of, you know, what happens when women start leaving these areas of work because of how challenging it is to just do the work. So I think that that's kind of an interesting transition into, you know, you work in a university system with young people that are about to enter the workforce. You know, what do you think would resonate with them seeing this story and maybe not having workplace experience yet? You know, is it something that they're going to watch and be disconnected to? Will they kind of understand it? Will it scare them away from these kind of workplace situations?
Well, it's interesting. I think that we see some extremes in the play. And I think some women might go and actually be disconnected. They might say, gee, I've actually not experienced anything like that. And which is not to say that women don't experience things like that. So there could be some disconnect. It's interesting because, for example, equal pay is an issue that we have out there on the table all the time. But we know today that young women going into jobs right out of business school, for example, often get similar or equal pay to the men coming out of business school. The issue isn't right when they come out. It's down the road. It's down the road where a woman has a child and some man assumes that she no longer is interested in her career or promotion. And then she doesn't get it, and so then her pay eventually is less than some men who she's more talented than. So it's hard to say. Some women might, young women might feel disconnect. But on the other hand, you have that young woman that I told you about, and it wasn't all that many years ago, that the guys on her team told her to shut up. So I think whether or not there's a disconnect might have something to do with the young woman's own experiences and maybe the experiences of women around her, like her mom or others that she knows, in terms of whether or not she'll realize that women do face sometimes some tough challenges out there. One thing that I think might be helping right now is how popular the Me Too campaign is. It's more or less helped people realize that both men and women, a lot more women have been dealing with sexual harassment than people really realized. So even if it hasn't happened to them, that Me Too campaign has brought the reality into the room for an awful lot of people that that happens.
Well, I think that's a lot to chew on.
Well, you know, I really do encourage people to come see the play, but I think also to have really interesting conversations afterwards. I think it's going to provoke a lot of thinking and feeling about what happens at work or what doesn't happen at work or what would I do if I was in that situation. And the thing I guess I would want young women to think about is that there is really, I keep saying, go to women outside the organization if you need to. There's really terrific opportunities for that. There's a woman named Sally Krawcheck who graduated from UNC, for example, and was, you know, a CEO in the investment banking field, which is a very heavily dominated male profession. And she's currently the CEO of Elevest, which is a financial investing platform for women. But more importantly, she has a group called Elevate, which is a community to help women invest in themselves and other women. And it's a place where women can bring these kinds of stories and get strategies and ideas from other women for how to succeed in their careers and how to deal with obstacles they might encounter, such as Eliza encounters in the course of this play. You know, what can she do? Getting advice from experienced women about what to do next. So that's one of the things I would want young women to know, or all women to know, is we actually are building a pretty good women's network out there. There's always been the old boys network, but I see women doing a better job of creating a network for women to support each other, and that's exciting for the years ahead.
That is exciting. So I'm curious, you know, you mentioned earlier that this is a topic that you have spent some time on. You know, what is it like for you to know that this story is going to be told and then to, of course, now be brought in as a part of this story being brought to the stage?
Well, I'm excited about it. I think I told you even before I had a chance to read it, just the idea that this topic is coming up allows people to have dialogue. And, the thing that's going to be interesting to me for you guys is, how are men going to react? And are men going to come see it? Will they actually identify with that there are male characters out there like the ones in the play? Will they feel that story is not accurate for them and how they are? It's going to be interesting. I think it's definitely a play that's going to get conversation happening. And it's almost like it messes with you enough that it's provocative and you have to talk about it. So I think that's why I would encourage people to go see it. But I think you're going to see some people saying, I don't know, is it really like that, or is it really that bad? And then some people are going to say, oh, yeah, I've been there. So it's going to open up some really great discussions. So I like that. Rather than keeping things under the table, let's get them out there and talk about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. And I mean, I think that is definitely, as kind of the artistic director of this theater, that's the reason I love theater and plays, is to incite conversation. And just the conversation that you've contributed to today, I can't thank you enough. I think that giving people context and these kinds of resources to listen to these podcasts before the play will also help encourage that dialogue and hopefully deepen it. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
No, you're welcome. I look forward to seeing the play.
Yeah. Thank you, Sharon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, listeners, thank you so much for joining us for this first podcast in our series of podcasts in support of our production of What We're Up Against by Teresa Rabeck. I hope that this conversation with Heather Strickland and Dr. Sharon Cannon really gave you some insight into the play and piqued your interest about coming to see it. I wanted to let you know that the play opens on January 12th and runs through January 28th. And the really important information is that this play is being performed off-site as our Gaddy Goodwin Theater is still being renovated. The show will be hosted at William Peace University in their Leggett Theater, and we're really glad to be in their beautiful space, and we are really excited to greet you there. Please take the time to listen to our other podcasts in this series, as the other folks who we interviewed have some really great insights into the play as well. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you at the theater.